In the late 1890s, Mark Twain made the terrible mistake of pouring his and his wife's life savings into a publishing company. Needless to say, they lost everything. At the peak of his fame, Mark Twain went bankrupt, and at risk of losing control of his most beloved masterpieces, such as Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, he decided to pay the debts quickly by embarking on a round-the-world speaking tour. Along the way, Twain delivered 122 stand-up comedy performances, the greatest hits of his career in a 90-minute one-man show. Richard Zacks writes about this time in his new book, Chasing the Last Laugh, Mark Twain's raucous and redemptive round-the-world comedy tour. Richard Zacks is the best-selling author of Island of Vice, Theodore Roosevelt's Quest to Clean Up Sin-Loving New York, and Pirate Coast, Thomas Jefferson, the First Marines, and the Secret Mission of 1805. Again, the name of the new book is Chasing the Last Laugh, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Richard Zacks to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Talk to us a little bit about what brought you to the subject and the specific year in the life of Mark Twain.
Well, I just thought it was amazing that someone could be at the height of their fame and pretty much lose it all, come on the brink of disaster, and then pull it all back together and have it basically a happy ending. I mean, it just, the idea that this man who was so famous and so funny could have this like gambler streak in him that he couldn't control, and he lost all his money and all his wife's money. I mean, if I lost all my wife's money at age 60, I mean, I just can't imagine how much she would hurt me, you know? And then Twain goes and kind of saves the day in the end. I mean, I don't want to give it all away, but that I was just so drawn to the story that the funniest man, that I think one of the funniest men who's ever lived, was put in this incredibly difficult situation and figured a way to come out of it. And I had access to unpublished letters and notebooks, and it was actually a lot of fun to go around the world with Mark Twain. So
it is the late 1890s, and he is at the peak of his fame. He goes bankrupt, and he's at the risk of losing his masterpieces, Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn. There was a lot at stake here.
He is. It's an interesting story because basically he created a publishing company because he felt like he had been cheated by publishers. I mean, it's a little like the Amazon, you know, battles that happened last year with Hachette. He wanted to get 50% of net profits. I mean, he figured, I did the writing, I at least deserve half of the profits, and he could never get it. So he decides he'll start his own publishing house, and he puts his nephew in charge, and at first they do amazingly well. They publish Ulysses S. Grant's memoirs, which was actually the biggest success in the history of American publishing to that point. And he publishes Huckleberry Finn, and then it's all downhill from there. The company just succeeds in lining up a bomb book after another, a disaster. They did the Pope's book. They spent a fortune on the book of Pope Leo XIII and sold almost no copies. They did Civil War generals. They did, by the end, they were doing the stories of the rabbis and the art of sketching. I mean, it just was a fiasco. And Twain winds up $80,000 in debt, which is basically the equivalent today of $2.4 million. He declares bankruptcy, and the term then was going into assignment, file for voluntary assignment. And you're absolutely right. If his books, his masterpieces, the creditors could easily have claimed them. And the thing that saved Twain, and it's kind of amazing, is that he became friends with one of the wealthiest men in America. It's like becoming friends with Bill Gates because he thought you were so funny at a cocktail party. And this guy, Henry Huddleston Rogers, H.H. Rogers, he advised Twain to do something that was borderline illegal, actually. He advised Twain to shift all of his assets to his wife before announcing the bankruptcy, which it's modern-day terms is a fraudulent transfer. And Twain did it, and he shifted Huck Finn and all the major books, and they were protected. And it was really funny. Twain would go into meetings with his creditors in the banks, and he'd have to say, well, my wife's books, I'm not sure what her plans are for Pudd'nhead Wilson. He using that advice from Rogers, he saved the copyrights. But the thing he didn't realize was he had transferred all of his assets to his wife. She now controlled the entire family fortunes. and she decided that he would have to pay off all his debts as soon as possible. Rogers wanted to pay 10 cents on the dollar. Rogers wanted him to do what, you know, frankly, what Donald Trump did in his bankruptcy, you know, pay a certain percentage. Nobody knows the exact number, but maybe it was 50%. Twain wanted to do that, and Rogers wanted to do that, and Livy, the wife, said, no, you're going to do the right thing. You're going to pay everyone back in full, and that's how this Round the World Comedy Tour started. She agreed to go with him, and he agreed to do it, and he wound up playing 71 different cities around the world, and almost no one has written about it. It's just kind of the lost comedy tour of Mark Twain, and it wound up making him quite a bit of money, and it wound up, you know, in effect, saving the books without the shame of doing something fraudulent, because if everyone gets paid back, it's no longer a fraudulent transfer. It didn't make any difference, in effect. So that's what Mark Twain did.
He delivered 122 stand-up comedy performances. Talk about the material of the show. It was basically about 90 minutes. How did he put it together?
It was great. He basically mined the days when he was, frankly, when he was younger and funnier. I mean, he took his greatest hits from his whole life, and he boiled them down into spoken bits. He would do usually six vignettes, say, during the 90 minutes, and they would range from like 6 minutes long to 15 minutes long. And he would blend them in, and they'd be things like the jumping frog of Calaveras County, or the time he stole a watermelon and discovered it was unripe and got very angry at the farmer, or the time some of the lines are just so wonderful. He said, the weather was too rainy to go to school and just rainy enough to go fishing. And he would he basically mined this material, and his delivery style was very unusual. Most people don't realize this. He was complete deadpan, never smiled at all, spoke in a slow voice, and he made you listen carefully. And he was unbelievably good at pauses. He would just, his comic timing, they didn't call it then, but his comic timing was unbelievable. And he had about 30 different short vignettes that he would blend in, because he needed to have three enough material for three shows in case he stayed in the same town. For sometimes he did five performances in a town, but he thought it was his duty to the audience that he at least have three complete shows. So he had to memorize 90 minutes times three. And he never held a book out. He actually thought it was criminal for authors to stand there and just head down and read. Mm. And he also thought it was criminal for comics to laugh at their own jokes. He says all of which makes you want to give up jokes and lead a better life.
You have a picture in the book, and you make note of this, but when he went on stage, it was very formal attire.
Right. People kind of, I mean, I pictured, I don't know, casual. I mean, all of us seen Hal Holbrook, or some of us have, but I pictured something more casual. I mean, here's the man we associate with Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer, and I had no idea that he was such a conflicted person. He wanted the respectability of that time period. He wanted both. He wanted to be able to be the wise guy, the irreverent guy, but he also wanted the respect, and that's what happened. The idea that he lost all this money is so extraordinary. He married a coal heiress. She was worth a fortune. Her money paid the daily bills. Her money built their beautiful home. And he basically used his money to play big shot and invest in things. And it's just amazing that he said, man will do many things to get himself loved. He will do all things to get himself envied. And, you know, those pithy little maxims that he came up, so many of them, once you start studying the man, he was so conflicted, and I love it about him. And he was called the funniest man on the planet, and all he wanted to do was be a literary writer. So he wrote personal recollections of Joan of Arc during this time period, which nobody remembers, and they shouldn't. But it was always the grass is greener. There was always, and you kind of, I love the striving about him, you know, and he pulled it off in the end. I mean, between H.H. Rogers advising and Livy advising, somehow or other, they came to the right answer.
You mentioned Hal Holbrook a moment ago, and you're right. I mean, so many of us think of that An Evening with Mark Twain that Hal Holbrook has done for decades. And was it similar to that?
It was a little different, because Holbrook I think he's great at it, but he's a little rambling and all over the map, and then he'll come in with a story or two. What Twain did was, and he won't use, you know, Twain didn't use his maxims. Twain basically created stories. Each one was a story unto itself. And the hardest part for him, and it's probably for a lot of stand-up comics, is how you get from one story to the next. And he thought for this trip that he would create a thing called the inoculation for morals, basically, how he would stand there. You have to picture him straight-faced and say that there are 467 crimes you have to commit, and once you've committed all of them, you'll never commit one again. I'm two-thirds of the way to salvation. You know, and those kind of lines went over really big to his audience, and literally people had to be carried out of the theater occasionally, and I tried really hard to set up the time period so that people would get in the right frame to appreciate, you know, the humor. I mean, the maxims, obviously, and everyone can relate to nowadays, but telling those stories and getting them to pop, and it's, you know, I'm bold-faced, I threw in pauses, I tried to get the spoken word on the page.
One of the things that's fascinating about the story that you tell is that here is arguably the most famous author in America, and even today considered the quintessential American writer. And the fact that not only did his tour take him through this country, but he went to Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa, and India. This was his success at doing this tour was found across the globe, not just in this country.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I would actually argue that his career was a bit on the skids at that point. And Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer were not considered classics then. They were considered young adult books. And he was considered the funniest man in America, but by no means this famous classic writer. And when he went around the world, I think Americans, we were an insecure nation, and we imported Paderewski and Jenny Lind and all these people from Europe and praised them to the skies. Well, it took Australia, New Zealand, India, South Africa, it took the world embracing Mark Twain for America to realize what it had. And all those clips, you know, everybody stole, the newspapers all stole from each other back then, and they just ran the articles. So all these clips of praise and stories and, you know, travel moments, they filtered back to the United States. So by the time he arrived, and he didn't come home for 4 years. I mean, he wound up living in Vienna for a couple of years. When he came home, he was hailed as the most enormous hero, an international star on one level, but also the man who paid everyone back when all the businessmen were hiding behind assignment and bankruptcy laws to escape their debts. And here was this man who paid everyone back. So his fame just catapulted thanks to this tour, and he saved his books.
Home to him was Hartford, Connecticut.
Right, but that's such a, in a way, a sad story, but I don't look at any of these things as sad. I look at them as dramatic, and he builds the house in the 1870s, but basically mostly his wife's money, and they make this gorgeous home, and they have three daughters, and they have three dogs, and he names one I Know, another one You Know, and another one Don't Know. He's just, they're having this happy family life, basically. I don't want to simplify it too much, but, and then he starts losing all this money. And by 1891, they cannot afford to live in their own home. It's amazing. Livy was very proud, the wife, and she didn't want to live there with, they had seven servants. They had a butler. They had a coachman. They had a carriage, several horses. She did not want to live there in a diminished style in front of her neighbors. So basically in 1891, they announced that Livy needed a rest cure in Europe, needed, you know, to go to the spas or the baths or whatever. And they left their home in 1891, and they never succeeded in getting back to living in Hartford again. They wound up selling it without returning there. And on some level, the goal was always to reunite the three daughters and the happy family life. And, that's one aspect of the story that they weren't able to pull off.
The idea of going around the country speaking, I mean, you mentioned that obviously it pays the bills, but do you make money off that? I mean, was it enough?
Oh, God, it was so lucrative by comparison. If you think about it, there's no television, there's no,
right,
no radio, there's no film. The only way that you could get to the next level of income was literally in the theaters. And it was considered extraordinary money. I mean, if you think about it, a workman back then, the working man's wage was about a dollar a day. And Twain, some nights, cleared $400. So he's making 400 days. He's making a year's salary in one night on the stage for a working man. So it was incredibly lucrative. The bigger the theater, he didn't want to play more than 1,500 seats because he didn't like to talk loud. He wanted to keep it intimate. But he could make extraordinary. The thing that I was surprised is the lecture agent, they called him lectures. America got 25%. He got a quarter of it, and the guy overseas was bargaining for getting 50% of Twain's money. I don't know if he wound up getting it. We don't have the exact final contract. But, no, you could make quite a bit of money performing.
When the tour came to a close, did it have a beginning, a middle, and an end planned, and how much of it was on the fly?
The tour was pretty much set. There are two people organized it. There was a Major James Pond in America, and then an R.S. Smythe in Australia, who handled Australia, New Zealand, India, and South Africa. And those guys, you know, back then there was telegraph, but telephone was very rare. So they would telegraph or send telegrams or write letters and organize all these things. And there would be some mix-ups and there'd be some problems. Like, for instance, he was supposed to play in Hawaii, and the ship coming in hit a reef and needed like a couple weeks of repairs. So there was no way we just take this for granted, but there was no way to tell Hawaii that Mark Twain was going to be 2 weeks late. And then cholera hit the day before he was supposed to perform, and they had sold a lot of seats. And he had been there early in his life as a Cub reporter, so he was incredibly disappointed to be in the harbor there and not able to go ashore. But basically they set out the parameters, and there'd be a few mix-ups here and there, but it was pretty much set.
This was about 10 years before he passed the tour.
Right, right. Well, 15 years. He went in 1895, and he took a year, comes back in, and lives in Europe for a couple of years. And the reason was he still owed money. And he was an incredibly proud man, and his wife even more so. And they didn't want to be humiliated by some creditors literally seizing him and hauling him off to a court with a lawsuit. There were three lawsuits pending against him. And if he comes back to the United States, he's vulnerable to legal action. And the headlines had already been when he went bankrupt. Literally, it said, Mark Twain fails. How would you feel it if you created this incredible career, you're the man who wrote Huckleberry Finn, and you have to see the front page of the newspaper say Mark Twain fails? So they decided not to come back until they could pay all the debts in full. And basically they did. And he actually had some comment in a letter that this is the first time that paying out money's given me more pleasure than pulling it in. And he comes home in 1900, and he has like a 3 months that you can't imagine. So it's almost a fantasy period where everyone in town wants to shake his hand, wants to host a dinner, wants to give him an award. And finally, he burns out on it. He's getting 7 invitations a day, and he can't stand it anymore. But for a while, he totally soaked it up and had his portrait painted by a few people. And, I think people, and it's unfortunate for me, that a lot of people associate older Mark Twain with this angry, negative, scowling. Well, that time period didn't hit until his wife, Livy, got sick and died. And that's 1904 and afterwards. And this time period that I'm doing is almost the most uplifting, because he goes through this horrible tragedy, and he and his wife together sort of pull out this amazing redemption. There is an incredibly sad part of his daughter passing during this time period. And I had, had access to the notebooks and things. And I almost think Mark Twain and his notebooks or writing letters to entertain H.H. Rogers is better material than his published works. I mean, especially around that time. He's so funny, and he's so direct. And I can relate. You know, I wrote some books that included sex early in my career, and books that had pirates in the title. I feel like I can't get the kind of respect I would love. And he was, you just can relate to so many things about him. Here he is, with the writing Huck Finn and still being treated as a second-class writer because it's not literature, So
The one word I want to, as we wind up our conversation, in the subtitle, Mark Twain's Raucous and Redemptive Round-the-World Comedy Tour, what was the raucous nature of the tour?
The raucous nature was the performances. I mean, there are also some. I mean, some of the sightseeing got pretty raucous, I would say too. But I mean, the performance is a really amazing material. But actually, now that I think about it, the raucous is. For instance, he went to India and fell in love with the place and just toured every moment he could. And he saw corpses floating in, you know, in the Ganges. He saw a holy man who was considered God. He watched this. He went up to the top of a minaret in a mosque and was trying to sightsee, and this monkey kept leaping across all these different, you know, rooftops. And he said, "I could not see the city. I could only look at the monkey. And if I had had, you know, to an effect, if I had had a gun, I would have shot it, you know, because it's just too distracting." He took. He was given this incredible perk of a. They set aside 35 miles of Himalayan railroad to let him use as a roller coaster. Coming down from Darjeeling in the Himalayas, the British railway authorities let him use 35 miles of track as a personal private roller coaster. I think it's one of the greatest celebrity perks ever. I mean, that tops anything I've ever heard of. And so he and his wife sit in a six-seater car whizzing down this mountainside with switchbacks and loops and zigzags. And he said it was one of the greatest days of his life. And I just think people don't picture Mark Twain, you know, in a roller coaster in the Himalayas after having ridden an elephant. You know, it's just another side of him.
Well, the book is fascinating and delightful. It's Chasing the Last Laugh, Mark Twain's raucous and redemptive round the world comedy tour. It is published by Doubleday. Richard Zacks, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing.
It was great. Thank you.
Great pleasure. Thank you. The name again of the book is Chasing the Last Laugh, Mark Twain's raucous and redemptive round the world comedy tour. It's published by Doubleday. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.